In this episode of The Critical Myth, the Critical Myth crew gets perturbed by Orphan Black, hits the target with 24, navigates the high seas with Crossbones, and sticks the landing with the 100. It's episode 459, The Transgender Variable.
Episode 459 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I guess it was a good thing I held off on my trip to London.
Yes, and I am Variable and full of perturbation. That's probably the only time I will actually say that title without completely messing it up. But we are going to be wrapping up this week's content with a few shows that Edmund and I solely watch. So hopefully you have also been catching up. But if not, I believe that Edmund has a warning for you.
Absolutely. We will discuss anything that might have happened in these episodes. That is our wont, that is our desire, that is our design, and it means you will be spoiled if you haven't watched them yet, but it's been a week or so, so we certainly hope you have.
Yes, indeed. And, well, Edmund, what do you think we should start with?
I think we should start with Orphan Black.
Yeah, we might as well, since I already referenced it. And here's the promo.
You are running out of time.
On an all-new Orphan Black.
You gotta find that cub. You have to find Beth Childs.
Cosima? Cosima! Cosima! We need the cub!
Orphan Black. All-new. Saturday at 9. Only on BBC America.
And if you could do the recap, please.
Certainly. Orphan Black, Season 2, Episode 8, Variable and Full of Perturbation. A new player in the clone conspiracy emerges and turns up at Felix's door, which sends him into crisis mode. Meanwhile, Sarah struggles with whether to surrender a crucial piece of leverage and strike a deal with Dyad.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, let's see. We've got a few different things going on here. Yep. Why don't we go ahead and start with the new player in the clone conspiracy, because I believe that that was probably the one that got most people's attention, and I know that, we have to score this one first.
Yeah.
I was jumping the gun just a little bit there. What would you give this one?
I would give this an 8.
An 8, okay. Well, as I was about to say, Henry gave this one a 6. He was not pleased with it. I would go with an 8 as well, though. But that was a little bit of a surprise to me, because I think that he felt like they maybe went a step too far. Mm-hmm. And that would be the introduction of Tony. What was your thought?
I will admit that it did throw me for a loop a little bit, because perhaps this was the intent, but I was really having trouble at first trying to, when we were first introduced to him at in the introduction, and it's obvious that it's Tatiana Maslany's, and that it's another clone, and really wasn't sure at first of exactly what gender he was. I say this may have been the intent, because certainly making him a trans male, it certainly makes sense that I would have some of that confusion, but I could see where then in terms of some people's reactions, the fact that it was her with this, you know, this little beard sort of slapped on, and them going with giving him that big mullet to deal with the hair issues. Did make it a little bit a little bit odd at first to really get a handle on it. That whole opening sequence, I was really not sure who we were watching. But I think that once they got into the main part of the episode, and certainly once he started interacting with Felix, Jordan Gavaris and Tatiana Maslany have this wonderful chemistry that is obvious just from watching some of the behind the scenes footage and interviews. I thought the two of them played off of each other so well, and you know, but also playing off the Felix's sort of discomfort and perturbation at being in the situation where, yes, here is this male version of Sarah that is coming on to me, and I'm kind of liking it. So it was certainly some very off-putting stuff for him to play, and it was certainly breaking them into new territory. I don't think it was done perfectly, but I think in the end it was done well enough for me to accept it.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to really say that. It's really, I guess for me, you know, there were some people that were criticizing. I don't think Henry was really going here. I think he was just thinking that this is almost like pushing boundaries for the sake of pushing boundaries. And I think there is perhaps a little bit of truth to that criticism. But I feel like this is such uncharted territory that it's like, I don't know that there is a way for them to have known if they were doing it the right way. They were just kind of going with their gut in a way. I think by explaining that it was a transgender in a bit of transition helped to mitigate some of the concerns over the fact that there's no way to make a male Tatiana Maslany and really make it work. She tried her damnedest, but it just really was off-putting because it just felt wrong. And not wrong in the sense that, you know, that a character would make that kind of choice, but it just visually didn't sync the way that one would expect it to. And so they kind of had to play around a little bit with how it worked. But, you know, I guess for me, it was just, again, it became so much the episode about that I can kind of understand Henry's worry, because it did derail the flow a little bit. But it also continued this process that I think is quite brave of the show, which is to never rest on their laurels. One quick aside is that this season, my daughter has been watching with us, and we got to this episode, and I'll give her this much credit. You know, the idea of like, okay, one guy's gay. Then we have Tony, who is, you know, in between at this point, traditional genders, and She's you know, kind of watching it going, so wait a second. So he's gay. This is a clone of his foster sister. And she's like, this is really awkward, isn't it? And I was like, you have no idea. And it was good that it was the awkward part was the relationship that was there. Not the situation. I mean, it was the situation, but it wasn't necessarily the elements in the situation, but rather the relationships that already existed and how this was playing into them. That was really the most awkward part of the whole thing. But I do believe that it did overshadow the episode's plot a bit more than maybe they were hoping that it wouldn't. I definitely feel like they knew they were pushing pushing boundaries, but I think they were hoping that the audience maybe wouldn't be as thrown off as they were. But I think that was also in terms of the choices that they made in how they presented it. Still, I don't think any other show has tried anything even remotely close to this.
No.
And what's amazing to me is the complete lack of just blowback that they've gotten. I haven't seen anything from anyone in terms of like some kind of major response. I mean, even minor response for that matter, in terms of it being, you know, considered improper or anything like that. It maybe this show is just so off the wall with all the different variations of the character as it is that maybe people just didn't even bother reacting to it. They're just like, yep, whatever, every type of clone you can think of. But what do you think? I mean, did it strike the right balance, or do you kind of see where Henry's coming from?
Yeah, I mean, I can see where Henry's coming from, but what's going to settle it more one way or another is how he gets integrated into the rest of the plot, at the way they were keeping everything so standoffish, and certainly, you know, with him basically being, you know, being put on a bus at the end, because it seems like, you know, it may just be this one off, but once you got past sort of the odd interactions and dynamics that it threw in, there is this question of this project seems to have been so relatively well controlled, even though you have, you know, the things like Sarah getting getting away and off into the wilderness more. But the question for me was what is his background, and how did he wind up in this similar situation to Sarah's, only even more extreme in terms of the outsider status. So I'm hoping that factors in somehow, and gives us a little bit more context and background to his character. If it's just, no, he's going to show up just so we can do this stunt, and then now we're bundling him off, and we're never going to hear anything more, you know, then I think Henry has more of a point.
Yeah, so I guess it maybe depends, like you said, on how they follow up on it. Now we have this other side of the episode, Sarah struggling with whether to surrender a crucial piece of leverage and strike a deal with Dyad. Thoughts on that one?
They've been setting this up for a while now. It certainly seems to be what will bring things to a head. With Cosima collapsing at the end, it certainly does seem that there's going to have to be some sort of accommodation made with Kira's DNA.
Yeah, it's to think of the I mean, we're seeing this also in terms of what happened with Dr. Leakey and the introduction of perhaps the bigger bad of Michelle Forbes, and it's in that context, right? I mean, if there's one thing in this episode that I was a little disappointed with, it's the fact that Leakey's death and Donnie's role in it was almost downplayed.
Yeah.
And really not a whole lot came of this introduction of the new Dyad mastermind, or whatever you want to call it. So I understand, though, that they were focusing quite a bit more on the timetable for Cosima and her survival. But this, again, gets back to what Henry was saying, where was too much time spent on Tony and other things versus following up on Leakey's death and the larger implications, because it almost feels like they lost a bit of an opportunity to set things up a bit more for the finale in terms of what Michelle Forbes and her character is going to bring to the table.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and thinking about it now, I mean, almost all the storylines there, this is odd for a show that has such a short season. And certainly last season, it was notable in terms of not having stuff that really could be described as filler and just really barreling through the plot as they went along. But here, between the Tony interlude and you know, Donnie and Allison, dealing with Leakey's body, but their plot, Allison in particular, does tend to be more of the comic relief, and it was certainly the case again this time with the two of them doing their bonding over there at mutual accidental murders and or semi-accidental murders, and then with Cosima as well, that whole plot line of where it was as much being played for laughs with her playing D&D or whatever game it was with Scott and his buddies. So yeah, it was kind of odd that they were pulling back, and all three plot lines could kind of be seen as interludes, but not even interludes that seemed to be doing that much to drive things forward.
Mm. Yeah, I'm really interested in seeing where these last couple episodes go. And are they going to be able to keep some degree of consistency? Right now, the second season is running right about maybe a tick higher in terms of score than the first season, but it's been pretty consistent, so I'm still waiting to see whether or not they can close this one out and make a nice jump up. or not. Well, that all being said, let's go ahead then and move on to our next topic. And what would you like to tackle next?
Let us move over to 24.
All right, and let's run the promo.
Please help me.
We've got a great chance at turning her.
Find out exactly where she is.
Your mother's targeting you with a drone. She's willing to kill everybody here just to keep you quiet.
Hospital in range.
There they are. Lock on target.
She's got a visual on us.
All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Absolutely. This is 24, Season 9, Episode 7, Day 9, 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. President Heller tries to stop Margot from going through with any further attacks while Jack and Kate race to save the life of a key player in the terror plot, and Jordan is ordered into the field on a perilous mission.
Mm-hmm. All right, and what would you give this one?
I will give this one an 8.5.
8.5. Okay. And I believe that I gave this one roughly the same. And I will let you know what the readers gave this one. I believe that they gave this one a pretty high score, maybe around a 9. But, well, I'll just start off in terms of my thoughts on this episode. This was certainly the most action-packed that we've gotten. I think in a lot of ways, this was almost the most 24 episode that we've had. Almost, you know, typical. And yes, I gave this one an 8.5, and the readers gave it a 9.5. I was a little bit off on that one. But yeah, it just was amazing to me just how they managed to pack so much into this episode, even with all of the action that they were delivering at the same time. In particular, you know, I will do a little bit of a mea culpa, not really on my part, but at least I'll give the writers credit where credit is due. I was really not happy with the fact that they just dropped this whole mole thing into the situation. It felt like such a cliche of 24 and every other season that they've done, but they actually managed to bring it into the story in a way that made a lot of sense. It connected with other things that we've seen. It further explored just what the problems and issues were with Chloe in this open cell group that she has been involved with. And yep. It fit very nicely into the larger question of, you know, what is an acceptable level of disclosure versus security, which is also expressed in the whole drone attack thing. Because, yeah, this is just one drone letting loose just maybe, what, half of its ordnance? And yet the destruction that we see is palpable, certainly a cut above anything we've seen so far. And it to me just was like this episode was all about demonstrating just what the cost is of some of these things. That there is a legitimate reason why people are concerned about these drones, because look at what happens when just one is under the control of a terrorist group, and there's five more out there, five or six. So yeah, to me it was like not only did it deliver on the action, but it went a little deeper than that. Which I wasn't expecting. That's not something that we really see from 24 very often.
Yeah, no, and certainly there was the sort of implicit in that was yes in the show there it is in the hands of a terrorist, but just the fact that they were showing what sort of destruction they cause, and just sort of leaving implicit the fact that the drone strikes that are ordered are ostensibly to take out one person or a few people, just as Margot was trying to do, but certainly, you know, wreak havoc on all of their surroundings. So there was, I did definitely got that sense of, you know, draw your own conclusions about how these things are used, period. I certainly agree with having not watched the other seasons, I didn't necessarily have that visceral reaction to a mole being introduced, but I did like the way it was then made much more nuanced and certainly gave Benjamin Bratt's character a far less of a sort of mustache twirling villain cast to what's going on, and the fact that he does seem to have been dragged into something that he didn't quite realize the implications of, and is now desperately trying to walk back, even as he's being forced into some even more difficult situations, as he sends Jordan out to try and take care of the situation, but certainly that was one of those elements where it was what was slightly cliched, yes, of course, when it's a crucial character, the cold-blooded assassin, yes, never quite seems to get the job done exactly right, but given what I heard about this show, I really was expecting that he might have been part of the collateral damage immediately, no, he is at least clinging on for now.
A little bit. We'll see how long that lasts, though. Among all of this, we also have this problem of Jack and his tactics and trying to get information out of Simone, and I thought that it was a nice counterpoint that, you know, it even given what was going on with the drones, was Jack's tactic justified? Was he going far enough in order, especially since we get to see that the fact that he couldn't get the information about Margot out meant that he had to try and get away with Simone, and that's what led to all the destruction from the drone attacks. So, yeah. You know, would it have been worth it if he could have gotten that information? But it does open up that door. And like I said, very, very often they will only pose these questions and then never actually explore them in any degree of depth. And I mean, sometimes the difference between a good season of 24 and a mediocre one has been their willingness to do so. But this was definitely, I can pretty safely say, and I'll just confirm that as I go back here, but yeah, this was the highest scored episode of the season, and I think it was certainly justified for that. Anything else for us to bring up for this episode, do you think?
I don't think so, although, it's obviously more the setup for what will be going on next episode, but Heller actually offering himself up was a twist that I wasn't... Did kind of see it coming, but still it's bringing up some interesting possibilities, and certainly the way they've been setting him up with it's almost there was almost that TV cliche of the moment somebody says they're going to retire or resign in this case, it does kind of mean that maybe he is more expendable than we might think, but we will find out.
Exactly. It's like you've just made yourself a red shirt. Thank you very much. All right. Well, I think what we're going to do is actually take a mid-show break, and then when we're back, we have a couple more shows that we want to cover, so stay tuned. All right, and we're back. And Edmund, before you make your next selection, I'll just point out that I am not up to date on Salem, so really it's between two choices.
Okay.
So which one do you think you'd like to tackle?
In that case, why don't we tackle Crossbones?
All right, and the recap, please.
This is Crossbones, Season 1, Episode 2, The Covenant. Blackbeard's master plan faces obstacles when a popular pirate captain arrives. Elsewhere, Tom Lowe becomes an instrument of Blackbeard's designs.
Indeed. All right, and what would you give this one, do you think?
I will give this an 8.
Okay. And I would probably go right around the same. So once again, well, it's pretty much what we gave the premiere. In fact, it's exactly what we gave the premiere. I mean, to that effect, I just want to say before we dig into much in terms of plot or anything else, that alone is a pretty impressive feat. Number one, the fact that it was such a highly scored pilot in the first place. But usually, even if it's a really good pilot, you have that first stumble when it goes from pilot to series because, yeah, you put a lot of attention into the pilot, but then you've got to figure out how to make it an ongoing narrative. And I think we were even fairly concerned that it felt like two-thirds of a film versus the beginning of a series. But how do you feel that this episode kind of assuaged that fear?
Well, I thought it was a good move to bring in this other captain and with his experience with Blackbeard from the old days, and it was a nice way of both introducing some conflict and also filling in some more of that backstory without it seeming too obvious. And certainly starting to introduce this whole idea of okay, what exactly is Blackbeard up to with this whole little community, and can he be trusted? And I thought that was a very very nice way of doing that. At the same time, I mean they're keeping a good balance of that background stuff going on and some good action. I mean that Blackbeard's fight against the guys sent to try and kill him I thought was very well done and certainly giving John Malkovich some very good material to chew on because he is this is definitely a role that he is just relishing and having a lot of fun with. And it's really, really coming across in the performance and the way it's being conveyed to the audience.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that this is the kind of role that really I could see him playing so over the top that it would ruin the show. And I'm surprised at how much subtlety he's actually giving Blackbeard in terms of characterization, because he knows, regardless of anything else, that this is his show. There's no doubt. I mean, come on, the opening credits is just Skull and Crossbones and then his face.
Yes.
Yeah, it kind of paints the picture, right? Literally. That said, I mean, yeah, he is kind of playing it slightly arch, but not so much that it's like, Ben Kingsley getting a paycheck arch. It's really quite quite well done. And I think maybe it was just a really brilliant casting move on the part of whoever got him and convinced him to do it, because, like I said, I think there are a lot of actors that would go way overboard with it and play it too dramatically. The menace is there. The calculation is there. And there's nothing that's going to sell you on the toughness of a character than the fact that he's having a very calm conversation while suturing his own head.
Yes.
That's impressive, even from a practical effects point of view. Yes, you can figure out how they were pulling it off, but it's still fairly impressive. Just the idea of it, and the fact that he plays such games with everything, and he's working out how to put people in his debt. And meanwhile, you've got, and forgive me, what was his name? The doctor. the spy that is there. I'm now blanking completely. I think it's Low.
Yes, Low. Yeah.
So Low and what he's doing, he's like the other side of the chess game, right? And I like the fact that we're seeing Blackbeard calculate how he can use Low and his suspicions of Low and what he can get out of that. And yeah, there's just a lot of nice nuances there. And they also played down a little bit the romantic side of things, where you have the slightly overly flirtatious young woman who then, of course, now is being given a bit more shade to her, which is nice. Although, did they or did they not kind of change her hair color in between episodes a little bit?
Not that I noticed.
It looked like her hair was a little darker this time. It was weird. But at any rate, no nude swimming scenes, sadly. No. But there we are. Yeah, to me, it was just a really good continuation of what we saw in the pilot. I almost felt like it could have been part two of the pilot. But it also made the case of why this show can continue forward without losing that momentum. Now, my question is whether or not they're going to be able to continue this show for more than a season. Mm-hmm. Because is Malkovich really going to be around that long?
Yeah.
And I don't see the show succeeding without him. That's kind of the problem, is that they've done such a nice job of centering this all on him that, at any rate, you were going to say.
I certainly felt that was the reason for introducing Lowe and Richard Coyle coming on board as the co-star, but you're right, it's a really open question whether they can build up his character enough to make it viable to continue. There is just one thing I want to mention that the crippled lord who is the husband of our the third point of that little love triangle that they're bringing in. I was rather astonished at on this island in the middle of nowhere that he was able to duplicate rebuild the chronometer quite this quickly. I really thought that was going to be more of a point of contention or something that was going to take a little bit longer before they had it in their hands again. So, you know, I think they took a little bit of dramatic license with that, but overall, the way the relationships are getting built up so far, that was just a minor quibble, and certainly not enough to take away my enjoyment of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were just talking in terms of turn and the fact that there were some odd aspects of, you know, the historical accuracy going there. And while I do completely recognize that you have, you know, this concern during that time period for precise navigation, I still think it's somewhat funny that this whole thing is over this really amazing thing that will calculate longitude.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, yeah. Okay.
The funny thing about all that is just the sort of absurd intricacy of the thing. I did read Davis Obel's rather wonderful historical memoir/novel. I mean, she's a New York Times writer who's carved out her own little niche of writing these very good books about that are essentially like nonfiction novels. And one of them was Longitude, about the inventor in England who did create the first chronometer. And it really is just you needed a very accurate timepiece just so you could measure that was the way that longitude got determined. So it would sync to Greenwich Mean Time. So I know that, no, there's no reason for it to be that complex. It really was just a very accurate clock. So, and they certainly haven't made any effort whatsoever to actually explain exactly what it does. It's just, yes, it's the magic machine thing.
Yeah, exactly. It literally should just have on the side of it stamped MacGuffin.
Yes.
That all said, I mean, like I'm saying, I completely feel like this season is going to be well in hand unless they go way, take a left turn into complete ridiculousness. But I don't see that happening. There's just such a consistent style already between these two episodes. And I still love the use of language on this show. It really compels you to listen. There's so many shows, even some of the ones that we like, where you can kind of have to tune out sometimes. Because it's just, you know, standard dialogue, but in this show they do a really nice job of making it distinct, and there's a certain culture to the way that they do things. And it, yes, it's basically, you know, Playcraft almost, the way that it's written. But it's a nice twist on what I guess you could say expectation. Even Black Sails didn't really do a lot of that. So it gives it something unique for, you know, against a lot of the shows that are even out there and that are even period pieces. It's not that florid in its language, which there's a certain just joy to that. Anything more about this episode of Crossbones?
Oh, well, just the one thing that really still hasn't gelled for me is Lowe's sidekick. I mean, he wasn't involved as much this episode, which I thought was a good move. But he's the one who still seems a little out of place of just this, and also just seems so borderline incompetent that why would Lowe keep him around? Because you know, having him there in the pilot, I mean, he seemed to be in the pilot primarily just so he could be the dumb person who Lowe could explain stuff to give us, you know, to info dump stuff. But I'm hoping they either shuffle him off somehow. But at the moment, he's the one member of the ensemble that just seems completely extraneous.
Hmm. All right. Well, I think that means that we have one more show to cover, and that would be the 100. And it's a season finale, no less. Let's go ahead and run that promo.
Those kids out there, they listen to you. They're willing to fight and die for you. We're gonna need that again before this day is through.
All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Certainly, this is the 100, Season 1, Episode 13, We Are Grounders, Part 2. Bellamy forces Octavia to make a difficult decision in the Season 1 finale. Later, Finn takes a risk.
Okay. That's one way of kind of wrapping it up. What would you give this particular finale?
I will give it... an 8.5.
Okay. Yeah, that's about what I was thinking as well, so we're not too far off. What's kind of ironic is that for me, it's really just a continuation of my thoughts and what I gave the previous episode. For you, it's a pretty nice jump back up where a lot of your thoughts were for the rest of the season. So for me, the really good thing about this episode was the fact that it brought things a little bit full circle, right? What were the exiled supposed to be trying to do? They were going to land near Mount Weather, where there was supposed to be this installation that would be presumably empty, that would be a shelter for them.
Yes.
And all season long, we find out that the situation on Earth is not what we supposed it was. There were still survivors. There was, in fact, enough variety among the survivors that there were internecine conflicts between the various groups of survivors. And... so I guess we shouldn't have been shocked to discover that, oh, yeah, people were at Mount Weather all this time. And they seem pretty much like the kind of military people that would have been around at the time of the war.
Yes, exactly,
right? I mean, it's like, duh, well, you know, just because they weren't communicating doesn't mean that they weren't there. It was a really nice twist for the... I know I'm going right to the end of the episode, but... I thought that was a really nice twist because it wasn't just out of nowhere. It basically, they kind of told you. It's just they didn't connect the dots quite the way that would have led you to that conclusion or led you to that suspicion. Maybe if you had read the source material, but I haven't, I know. So I was kind of taken aback. I was like, oh, wow. And then I thought about it and said, well, of course, that makes perfect sense. I'm surprised that they were probably sitting back and watching what was going on to see how things would pan out.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, so it... go ahead.
Presumably, it's... the more sort of barbaric hordes we've been seeing, you know, were the presumably have the numbers, and you'd imagine that, no, it was just a small cadre that was manning that station. And, you know, yeah, so through however... you know, the few generations of over 97 years, you know, yeah, they've expanded some, but yeah, it would still be sitting back and using their advantages in terms of technology and being quite literally on the high ground. not moving out from the base except when absolutely necessary. But I do like the way they kind of lulled you into this whole, we're in a Lord of the Flies situation. Everything's barbaric and everything's reverted. And then hitting you at the end with, there are a few survivors who still have some technology around them.
Mm, yeah. It completely changes it changes the game, even as the game was already being changed fundamentally by the fact that the Ark was being sent down to Earth.
Yes.
And again, I love the fact that they don't hold back. As kind of obvious as some people thought that the Ark going down to Earth was in general, well, it didn't quite turn out as easily as they thought it would. I think so Zane and Abby are down there, and of course they were going to be, because why else spend all this time if you're just going to kill them off? But they killed off a pretty significant number of the people that were supposed to survive, and pretty nastily, too. I mean, the number of charred and burned up bodies in this particular episode was pretty high, with that wonderful bit of parallel between what Clark's plan did to the Grounders at the exact same time that people on the Ark were being cooked by reentry. Really nice symmetry there. I'm still not entirely sure that I forget the title that they give the guy up in Isaiah Washington's character. I'm not entirely certain he's going to die up there.
I was kind of wondering that myself. I mean, the whole thing of, they only had limited amount of air if everybody was there. Now that it's just him, how much longer can he hold out?
So. Exactly. They made it seem like he was running out of air almost immediately, and then it was like, oh, not so much. He seems awfully okay. He's just kind of...
Yeah, he's going to have one heck of a hangover in the morning. But
yeah, exactly. Or none, depending on... if he just decides to vent the air and get it over with. But yeah, it's interesting just how this is going to pan out. I love the fact that they've given these shades to the characters of Zane and Abby. They're not just cardboard cutouts. Even in 13 episodes, they've really done a nice job of softening Zane's zealotry and over-pragmatic point of view. They gave Abby a lot more shades to what she was doing. I can see them working together. I guess you could say here's another parallel, which is another thing I really like about this episode, is that you've found over the course of the season that Clark and Bellamy came to a certain degree of understanding between the two of them. The same thing has happened between Zane and Abby. And under different circumstances, but you basically got to see, mother and daughter have an effect on the male, the aggressive male that was their main antagonist in terms of leadership. And again, I think that they did it in such a way that it wasn't beating you over the head with it, but it is there. You can see the progression, and you can see how they paralleled that forward without, again, beating you over the head with it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, the way they've done all season, even though there is the love triangle elements to it, they continued in this to have those take that back seat to the main action. And it was even nicely done in terms of the way they set up some of those final twists and separations, and the whole thing of with Octavia getting injured, so she and Lincoln do wind up together, but it's still organic to what they've been setting up in terms of the situations all season. So and also, I mean, it was certainly interesting payoffs in terms of the way they had taken out some characters, particularly the Chancellor. That's the son of the Chancellor early on. So then, when it came down to that final moment where they have to turn on the rockets, even though you've got these main characters outside, and I think even with that, it's an open question of did Bellamy and Finn actually get cooked or not? But because they'd already shown that willingness to take out some characters, it certainly leaves it where you are you are not sure of who's actually coming back, or whether they did in fact just decide to take out these two characters you would assume have earned their right to stay in the show. But luckily, of course, it has been renewed, so we will find out next season.
That's right. Yeah, it's unconventional in a lot of ways, and that's one of the things that I really quite enjoy about it. What else is there to say about it? I mean, it was nice in that it was a fairly. I will say that the battle with the grounders, both sets of grounders, in fact, was fairly messy. I mean, there was it wasn't nearly as straightforward as one would think. Even when they were finding solutions that they needed to survive, you had this race against time with Raven, and if not her survival, then at least her consciousness. So it was a really nice bit there. But what else is there to say about this one?
No, I mean, just that I think it was a very good, satisfying finale. That it was a case of it was one of a shorter 13 episode season, but I thought they did do a really good job of setting up these situations both on the ground and up in orbit, Yeah, it's become a bit of a cliche to put things in these terms, but this is a show where it's actually completely appropriate to say they stuck the landing.
Nicely done. All right. Well, if that's it, then I guess we are going to go ahead and wrap this one up, and we'll see, I guess, next week what the summer brings.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time. Watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.